Happy Russia Day. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. It's Russia's national holiday today, and thousands celebrated by protesting Vladimir Putin's government.
Today is a day which will be remembered by many young people. Police grabbed young women and young men and dragged them away from central streets and central squares of Russian cities.
Plus, a German orchestra conductor travels to Mexico to organize a concert against Trump's border wall.
I grew up in East Germany. I was surrounded by walls.
And a woman surfer in Morocco gets a boost from her mom.
They said to my mom, tell her to stop surfing, it's not good for her. But she told me, just go to surf, don't care about what they said.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. One image that we have of today's Russia is that nothing happens there without President Vladimir Putin's approval. Well, maybe almost nothing is more accurate. Today, thousands of Russians joined anti-corruption protests in cities all across the country, and Russian police responded by reportedly arresting hundreds of protesters. And that's just in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And the main protest leader, opposition politician Alexei Navalny, was arrested outside his home before he could even take part. The World's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Now, I hear the scene was kind of surreal because the demo in Moscow coincided with a very kind of nationalist holiday, Russia Day. Describe the contrast.
Well, it was a very strange scene. So originally, this protest was supposed to take place in a kind of cordoned off section of Moscow. Navalny's camp complained that the mayor was essentially sabotaging that plan by not allowing any companies to allow them to rent sound gear. So they threw up the plan in the air and said, look, we're going to go and march on the center street in Moscow. This is Tverskaya Street, right down near the Kremlin. And this is Russia Day, as you noted. It's a national holiday. And you had this exhibition going on with a focus on Russian victories through time. So you had people in World War II gear. You had people from sort of the Middle Ages. So in some ways, it kind of resembled a Renaissance fair. And you had this kind of strange moment where you had people protesting and then people in these costumes all kind of lingering about. And of course, some tourists kind of caught up in the melee. And then just Russians who just wanted to take up, you know, the holiday. So it was kind of this strange moment where you weren't really sure who was there for what reason. And that was one of the problems that the riot police had initially as well.
What's the emotion? What's the rage behind these protests?
Well, it centers on Navalny has been conducting a series of essentially investigative campaigns using YouTube viral videos as his sort of modus operandi. So he's been tapping into Kremlin corruption among the inner circle, and particularly he's focused on the prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev denies the charges, but this has been enough to rally people out on the streets now several times. And, you know, once again, there's a sense that no matter what is exposed in terms of corruption, that there's nothing, that the Kremlin doesn't seem to care. So there have been no investigations into these allegations. There's been no response by the government other than to say it's not true. And you see this is just kind of building rage, but it also is very interesting just to see how it's connecting with a very young audience, teenagers basically.
Tell us about one of these young protesters. I know you talked to a few. What got them out there on the street today?
Well, you know, so I talked to several high school students. You know, you'd come up and talk to them, and they said, just want to play one clip of tape here. And we're listening to, this is Danila, and then we'll hear from Nastya, Anastasia. And Danila's a 10th grader, Anastasia's a 9th grader. And they're basically saying, look, you know, my sort of conscience got me out here because I feel like you have to do something to change the country for the better. And Nastya responds. Essentially, if they don't come out, things will only get worse. And the window is closing for this opportunity to make changes in Russia. That's how they feel.
Now, who's organizing these protests? You sort of infer that they're taking place across a really vast country. How are they being organized?
This is all from Alexei Navalny. This is the opposition leader. He's also a long-shot candidate for the presidency in 2018. Russia has presidential elections next year. And Navalny has run this anti-corruption foundation now for several years, and he's been using, essentially leveraging the internet, because he's essentially banned from state television, to basically get people interested in the ideas of corruption and exposing these schemes that are used by Kremlin insiders. So, you know, the more outrageous ones can be everything from villas to stolen money to, for example, a Kremlin advisor who flies his pet corgis around to dog shows all across the world. So, you know, he seems to have this knack for kind of tapping into this very cynical, very funny style of kind of gonzo journalism.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. At the center of today's protests is Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption campaigner who is now Russia's highest profile opposition activist. My colleague in the BBC Russian service, Yuri Vendig, has been following his rise. Yuri, who is Alexei Navalny and how did he become so influential?
Well, at the moment, he is definitely the most prominent figure among the Russian opposition, which is very fragmentized. And at the same time, he's the only one who can organize such a big event like today's one with protest rallies, pickets, and so on in dozens of the Russian cities.
What is it about his message that is attracting people?
This is his strategy, which makes him so popular. The Russian opposition is very much fragmented. But his focus on corruption is something which unites the Russian opposition, although the opposition is still pretty weak in Russia. And we can see that also from today's protests. In every single city, there were hundreds, maybe thousands in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but this is quite a small number.
Now, Navalny built his fame by bypassing TV and traditional media and using social media. Is that strategy still working for him?
Well, he's not bypassing TV. He's banned from the state-controlled TV in Russia. Almost all the TV channels in Russia are firmly controlled by the state. As for the social media, yes, he is successful in this field. As I said, he's the only one who can organize such a wide protests all over Russia from Vladivostok to St. Petersburg.
Yuri, I understand Alexei Navalny kind of really gets how to call attention to himself and his mission. What has he done in the past to do that?
Well, as I said, several years ago, he has started to fight against corruption, and in the recent years, he has created his quite a big team called Fond Борьбы с коррупцией, that is the foundation for the fight against corruption. And they publish thorough and interesting investigations. Basically, they work as free and independent journalists in today's Russia, because normal, usual media in today's Russia cannot work and cannot do that. Somehow they manage to do that, and they publish various revelations about the Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, accusing him of having secretly villas in Italy and so on.
So they expose embarrassing information in the media about their opponents.
Yes, that's what they do. And in these endeavors, it's quite an open secret that they are being supported by some rich and liberally minded people in Russia.
How has the Kremlin responded to Alexei Navalny's movement so far?
Well, the Kremlin has opened several criminal cases against him, accusing him of embezzlement and fraud. But I, as a person who reported about two of these trials, in both these cases, the authorities didn't just falsify the materials for the court, but they bluntly accused Alexei Navalny of something which is not a crime according to the Russian legislation. They just told me that was just a normal, simple business, and they said this is the crime. And so the trial was not fair. But at the same time, Navalny still is not in prison.
Yuri Vendig is with the BBC's Russian service. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next week, Britain is scheduled to start negotiating its exit from the European Union. But instead of focusing on that, Prime Minister Theresa May is busy trying to save her government. May suffered a huge setback last Thursday when her Conservative Party lost its majority in Parliament after a special election. Now May needs the support of another party to get things done. And that's why she's in talks with the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland. But the DUP's support is likely to come at a price, especially when it comes to social issues and the specifics of Brexit. Alan Mabin is a political commentator based in Belfast. Alan, can you tell us a little bit about the DUP and its platform?
Well, the DUP is the largest unionist party, and by unionist we really mean that they want Northern Ireland to stay as part of the United Kingdom, and if you like, their opposition would be nationalist parties who would wish Ireland to recombine North and South. So the DUP would be, I suppose, the hardline unionist party that we have in the North. They have grown over the last kind of 10 or 20 years, and they took over half the seats available in Northern Ireland at Thursday night's general election. And so there's been kind of a turnaround. They have come from being at the edges of politics to actually being right in the centre.
So Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. What's the DUP's stance on leaving the EU?
The DUP as a party came out as wanting to leave the EU. They got money from various sources that were trying to run a lot of advertising nationally across the UK in order to convince people to leave. So they're very firmly wanting to see Brexit. However, they do understand that Northern Ireland is in a unique position, that they have a border with Europe, because between North and South of Ireland, we have a land border. So they know that something will have to happen to make that not so bad. And so they're very conscious of the need to make sure that we don't disadvantage Northern Ireland as part of the UK. But on the other hand, they won't want any reversal in the decision to leave.
How could Brexit affect the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland?
At the moment, there's a lot of uncertainty as to how it will affect it. We know that economically, there are companies producing liquor, that it gets produced on one side of the border, it gets shipped across in order to be bottled, and then it gets kind of brought back to be labelled, and then it gets taken back again in order to be distributed around the world. So we know that there's industry on the island. There's also a lot of farming and agriculture on the island, where things go across the border on a very regular basis. So anything that would slow that down or change taxation of it, that would be very detrimental to our small economy. Also, in border areas, people tend to live on one side and work on the other. It's quite a porous border at the moment. So anything that would make that a harder border with customs checks or security checks, that would be going back to the bad old days of the Troubles when we used to have the army on the border. So we want to kind of avoid that if at all possible.
Now, I know there are some issues between Theresa May's Conservative Party and the DUP, and they really clash on some key issues. What are they?
Well, the Democratic Unionist Party would be socially conservative when compared with other parties across the United Kingdom. So they'd be very anti-abortion. They'd be very anti-same-sex marriage. Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK which doesn't have same-sex marriage at the moment. So on those kind of issues, they're very kind of tight and conservative with a small c. However, those are unlikely to be the issues that they actually negotiate with in order to lend their 10 votes to support Theresa May. I think it's much more likely that the party will be looking for money in order to benefit Northern Ireland. So that will be around infrastructure, that will be around health, and that will be around perhaps protecting some of the European subsidies that will disappear when Brexit happens and we leave the European Union. And that's likely to be the kind of economic input that they're going to look for in return for their votes. I don't think we're going to see social issues being raised.
Is the Democratic Unionist Party enjoying being courted?
I think all politicians really want to have power. That's why they get into the game. And suddenly, they have been accelerated into the kind of the top flight of politics within the UK again. So I think they're enjoying their moment in power, but they'll have to learn to be responsible and not ask for too much. You know, we have got a lot of money and investment in Northern Ireland as part of the peace process in order to build this back again after many years of trouble. So we're used to asking for money, but we need not to be seen to be begging this time. We need to actually be kind of adult politicians as opposed to amateurs just looking for a fast buck.
That's Alan Mabin, a political commentator based in Belfast. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks.
A vote for statehood in Puerto Rico. So what's next? That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Yesterday, the Puerto Rican community celebrated in New York. It was the National Puerto Rican Day Parade. And Puerto Ricans on the island hit the polls to vote on a long-standing question: should Puerto Rico become the 51st state? Residents of the island, which is a U.S. territory, chose between becoming the newest state in the Union, becoming an independent nation, or remaining as is. The turnout was quite low, but overwhelmingly, those who voted, voted for statehood. Joining us today to explain what comes next is Julio Ricardo Varela, co-host of In the Thick, a political podcast from the perspective of journalists of color. Julio, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here.
Now, the debate about statehood or nationhood for Puerto Rico is hardly a new one. How is yesterday's vote different from previous efforts to change the island's status?
Oh, man. It's really not. Essentially, it's not much has changed in a lot of ways. I think people don't understand that this is the fifth plebiscite since 1967. A couple of things that people need to kind of step back for a second and kind of look at this. This was supposed to be a plebiscite that actually was going to determine statehood or independence, which would remove the current Commonwealth status. So it was going to be an either or, and that was going to be historic. But because there was complications or a lot of politicizing from the status quo party, the Department of Justice came in April and said you have to add Commonwealth to the ballot or else we're not going to give you federal funds to help educate people about the plebiscite.
So what you're saying is originally the vote was going to be either statehood or independence and no option to say, no, let's keep it as is.
Exactly.
And so that was inserted. And then for a whole host of reasons, a whole lot of people stayed home.
There was a completely low voter turnout. And historically, Puerto Ricans go out to the polls anywhere from 80% on the high end to about 55% on the low end. So to have a 23% voter turnout starts raising questions about, well, is it the will of the people?
It was a very small percentage who voted. And this was
right.
A non-binding referendum. So
right.
What's next? Even though an overwhelming majority voted, not many people showed up. So where do we go now?
It depends who you talk to. If you talk to the pro-statehood governor of Puerto Rico, he passed a bill. His pro-statehood legislator passed a bill called the Tennessee Plan. And for all you historians out there, it's basically a plan that Tennessee used to become a state of the union in the late 19th century, I believe. And basically what it's done is like Puerto Rico voted, and then now they're going to create a commission, and they're going to pick five representatives of Congress and two senators, and they're literally going to go to Washington, and they're going to demand for offices. And it's one of the things that we're talking about on the In the Thick podcast about, like, imagine this image of like seven Puerto Ricans showing up to the Capitol and saying, we need our congressional offices. How is that going to play out? So that's what the pro-statehood movement is going to do.
And ultimately, though, it's up to the U.S. Congress to decide.
It's totally
on
up
statehood.
To the Congress.
So,
but it's going to, yeah, it's totally up for the Congress. And then you have a Trump administration that really hasn't gone on record. The Department of Justice has not approved the plebiscite. There's a lot of holes to this. So if you're a Commonwealth supporter, you're going to be like, hey, the vote's not valid. It's only, not a lot of people came out. And you're literally going to send like people to the Capitol during the Trump administration.
The other thing that most of us hear about all the time about Puerto Rico is the crippling debt and the economic mess. Is that backdrop, did that fuel this vote? Has that added urgency to the issue of statehood?
Puerto Ricans don't agree a lot politically, but they're starting to see that the debt crisis and everything that's going on when you have a fiscal control board that is literally running the country's economy, that is also neo-colonial in nature. So I don't think anyone's disputing the current territorial status as having to change. I think what you have is the status quo people who are afraid to participate, who have no political direction, and lost a major opportunity to kind of counter what's going to happen with the statehood party. There's going to be a lot of media around this. And, for Americans living in the mainland, they don't have a good sense of what's going on. So they're just going to see like all these Puerto Ricans going to the Capitol, and they might get arrested. Trump might talk about it. So who knows where it goes next?
Julio Ricardo Varela is co-host of In the Thick, a political podcast from the perspective of journalists of color. Thanks a lot, Julio.
Thanks, Errol. It was great.
Take care. The Atlantic coast of Morocco is known to surfers for its powerful point breaks, and Moroccan men have long competed on the World Surfing Tour. Now, as David Fox reports, Moroccan women are starting to join them.
The scene at the Agadir Open looks like something out of a Southern California surf competition. A white sand beach, a DJ booth blasting pop music, and clusters of young men in board shorts. But the mint tea on the judges' table and blue fishing boats along the shore give it a distinctly Moroccan feel. The ridge above the beach is packed with locals come to watch hometown favorite Maryam El-Gardoum compete in this competition's first ever women's finals. She rides a pink surfboard in a crimson wetsuit. After 20 minutes, an air horn blasts, and El-Gardoum pumps her fist in the air. She's won. She catches her last wave into shore and chats with some of the older women watching from the beach.
They told me that's when I was in my heat for the final. They were so happy for me.
At age 20, El-Gardoum is a four-time national champion. But she says this is the first time she's gotten such public support from the women in her own village, Tamrakt.
Like when I meet the people here, they say, where you come from? Yeah, I'm from Morocco. I live in Tamrakt. They surprise it.
Surprised to find a world-class surfer from a relatively traditional village, where most families, including El-Gardoum's, earn their income from fishing, farming, and goat herding. But the area is changing fast. Surf tourism has exploded here along the coastline. The change is visible in the streets. Locals on motorcycles now share the dirt roads with SUVs packed with tourists and boards, and men are constantly at work on construction projects serving the tourist industry. Despite the new jobs, El-Gardoum says some of the men here still aren't sold on surfing and don't approve of local women and girls taking part in the sport.
They say if you go to surf, you're gonna drink alcohol, you're gonna smoke, you're gonna go with the boys.
El-Gardoum says she gets pushback from local women, too.
They said to my mom, tell her to stop surfing, it's not good for her. But she told me just go to surf, don't care about what they said. And then I keep surfing, you know. Like, if I keep thinking about what they said, I'm never gonna do, like, nothing.
But there are other barriers keeping Moroccan women from the waves. Fatima Zahra Brada is another champion surfer. She and El-Gardoum are the first Moroccan women to represent their country in the ISA World Surfing Games.
C'est un sport qui est onéreux. C'est pas un sport.
It's an expensive sport. It's not open to everyone. Unfortunately, there are a lot of talented young people who don't have a way to make a living off of their passion.
Barada says her success wouldn't have been possible without financial support from her family. She says the creation of Morocco's National Surfing Federation, which picks up the tab for the national team, has helped reduce costs for top-level competitors. But she and El-Gardoum say it's not enough. They want to see women get sponsorships from international surf brands, the same ones that support the Moroccan men competing abroad. And they'd like to see more surfing associations sponsor girls so one day they can get a shot at international competitions too.
To tell all of the world that, yeah, there is a girl surfers in Morocco.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I want to say.
Yeah.
For the world, David Fox, Agadir, Morocco.
David's story was produced in association with Round Earth Media. We also have some great photos of the surfers over at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, he survived the attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando.
It really freaked me out. I thought I was going to lose my life at that moment.
1 year later, he's still going out to clubs.
Don't let it stop you, you know, because you only live life once, and don't let nobody take that away from you. We're not going to let no terrorists do that.
That story's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Today marks 1 year since the attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. It was one of the worst mass shootings in U.S. history. 49 people were killed. And today, the city is paying tribute to the victims and continuing its long healing process. Reporter Crystal Chavez is covering today's events for station WMFE in Orlando.
There are just signs everywhere around town, Orlando United stickers, on business windows, on cars. Pulse has really been with us in the past year. It's like people mark the six-month anniversary. So while much of the country might have moved on, Pulse has really kind of been present even in the past year for us here.
I know you talked to one survivor of the shooting, Orlando Torres. He was at the club that night. How did he manage to survive?
Yes, he was actually a promoter for Latin nights at that club. And he was in the bathroom with a friend when he heard gunshots. And some people thought it was the music. And he was like, no, 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 I know my DJ's music. So he told his friend to get into a stall with him. They got on top of the bath, on top of the toilet, so they could hide their feet from the gunman. And they stayed there for 3 harrowing hours. At one point, the gunman came into their bathroom.
I did not try to budge or move or twitch. I just played as if I was dead. I didn't react to his touching. And I was expecting after that just to be followed by a spray of bullets on my lower back. And yeah, it really freaked me out. I thought I was going to lose my life at that moment.
That's amazing. What eventually happened to Torres? How did he manage to leave the club?
Well, police finally, after 3 hours, blew a hole in the wall. And that broke pipes. There was water spewing everywhere. Orlando Torres talked about it felt like he was drowning at one point. Well, people were being taken out through a hole. Orlando got stuck. He said it was a small hole and a police officer had to yank him through and force him out, and he hurt his shoulder. He said when he got to the hospital, that's when everything really started to sink in and he was processing what he had just went through. So he asked someone at the hospital to turn on the TV for him.
Then pictures started popping up and it struck me hard in that bed. Just seeing friends' faces that I knew, I said hello and never had a chance to say goodbye.
1 year on, how is Torres doing, and will he be at today's tributes?
Yes, surprisingly well, it seems like. Some survivors I talk to have become really reserved and don't want to talk about that night. Torres is unique in that he's very open. He very much has taken a survivor identity, and he wants to tell the stories. He lost 15 friends in the massacre, and even in the past year, he's gone to every memorial, every tribute. He wants to tell his friends' stories, and yes, he will be a big part of many, many tributes going on today in Orlando.
And does Torres still go out to gay clubs in Orlando?
Yes, I asked him that, and he does.
Be alert, be cautious. Yes, no doubt. You look at your surroundings. Know your exits, you know. But don't let it stop you, you know, because you only live life once, and don't let nobody take that away from you. We're not going to let no terrorists do that.
I remember last year when this horrible incident happened, and it turned out a number of the people going to the Pulse nightclub were gay and lesbian, but they were not out to their own families. They came from conservative Latino families. Did the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub act as kind of a coming together and a healing for families, or are some families still estranged over that issue?
Families are complicated. There are some families that are closer now and after the event, and it forced some difficult conversations. And some people still haven't changed their mind on these issues. Some people moved from Puerto Rico to Central Florida to get away from a machismo Latino culture and not being accepted by fathers and uncles. And so some of that has stayed, but you also see sort of a progress in opening the dialogue. And for some people, Pulse inspired them, even though they weren't there, to come out to their families.
What's happened to the Pulse nightclub itself?
Well, the Pulse nightclub itself is still gated off. There are still memorials and flowers and candles outside to this day, and people visit almost daily, day and night. We are trying to figure out as a city what's going to happen to that space. The city had wanted to buy it, but the owner kept it, and she's created a board that will figure out how they're going to make that sort of a national monument. They are looking to other national monuments, such as the 9/11 monument, and trying to do something special like that here in Orlando.
Crystal Chavez is a reporter at WMFE in Orlando. We've been talking to her about the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub mass shooting. It happened exactly 1 year ago today. Crystal, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Today also marks 50 years since the Supreme Court struck down bans on interracial marriage. The case centered on Mildred and Richard Loving. She was black with Native American ancestry. He was white. They lived in Virginia when they decided to marry. And at the time, mixed-race marriage was against the law in that and several other states. Lawyers from the ACLU took the case to the Supreme Court. But there was another lawyer who presented arguments against the ban. David Muto wrote about him for The New Yorker last year. The story is called An Unsung Hero in the Story of Interracial Marriage. David, I never knew this part of the Loving story. Tell us about the lawyer, William Muratani. And he was Japanese-American, and why was he filing a brief in this case?
Yeah, so William Muratani was the national counsel for a group called the Japanese-American Citizens League, a civil rights organization that is still in operation today. And they filed a brief in the Supreme Court case in support of the Lovings. And it turned out that the Supreme Court thought that they had a pretty compelling argument, and they invited the JACL to come and give about 15 minutes of oral testimony in the case. So Muratani, being the lead lawyer, got to stand up in front of the judges for about 15 minutes and make his argument.
What was his argument against the law, and how is it different from the main challenge?
Muratani had a couple of unique arguments, both of which focused on kind of the incoherent way that the state of Virginia defined race. So at the time, Virginia banned white people from marrying anyone with even a drop of non-Caucasian blood. So Muratani made the point that, you know, given the history of Western civilization, it would probably be hard for even most white people to prove that they were 100% purely Caucasian. And he also noted, you know, that the interpretation of people's race in Virginia was left up to the people issuing the marriage licenses. You know, it would be county clerks who were essentially deciding people's race. And because of those factors, he thought that this was a vague law that perpetuated white supremacy.
And of course, the law as it was written was also, as you mentioned, it was about who whites could and couldn't marry. So these laws prohibiting interracial mixing were really about whites marrying other people. So that also kind of exposed it for what it was.
Right, exactly. So his other point was that the Virginia law only prohibited white people from marrying outside their race. It didn't, you know, ban black people, for instance, from marrying Asian people. So the state said that this was in the interest of maintaining racial purity. But because that only applied to white people, Muratani argued that this was clearly a white supremacy law.
Why was this issue so important to Muratani?
You know, Muratani has a really interesting history. He unfortunately passed away in 2004, but he has a really storied career. And the people I talked to for this piece said that his life's work was probably informed by the fact that as a young man, he and his family were sent to Japanese internment camps during World War II. And I think that that factor, among probably many others, led him to fight for civil rights throughout his life. In the 70s, he was a volunteer civil rights lawyer in the South and went on to be the first Asian American judge in the state of Pennsylvania. So he had a lot of contributions.
Now, David, you wrote this in a very personal way. Your parents, their own marriage is kind of resonant of this case. What did the Loving decision mean to them?
So my dad is Japanese American. My mom is white. They married in Virginia in the 70s. So just a few years after Loving versus Virginia was decided. And, you know, my parents, I think, always had a vague awareness of this case. But it wasn't until I started researching the piece that I found out that they were direct beneficiaries of this and that my family may not have existed, you know, if these laws had stood when they tried to get married. So, you know, finding out that Muratani, who was this Japanese-American man like my father, realized that ending these laws meant to prevent intermarriage between white people and black people would also pave the way for families like mine was really powerful. And it's something that I still think a lot about. This case has made me think about the, you know, intersection of love and law and family. There's actually another deeper connection for me, which is the fact that the Japanese internment camp where Muratani and his family were held was actually the same one where my grandparents were held. And it was the same one where my grandparents actually had their wedding. So to find out for me that that my connection to this case, you know, kind of spanned generations has been just as powerful.
David Muto is a senior web producer for The New Yorker. He wrote about the William Moratani and Loving case for NewYorker.com. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
Now back to our top story of the day. Thousands took to the streets across Russia today to protest the government of Vladimir Putin and the corruption associated with his government. These protests took place in several Russian cities. Earlier, we heard the view from Moscow. Now we're going over 1,000 miles to the south, to Sochi. Reporter Anna Nemtsova is there today.
Even here in Sochi, this is a resort city where they're having a big film festival this week, a place where Putin likes to visit. He has a summer residence here on the Black Sea. Even here, people came out to protest against corruption. But it was interesting to see a lot of Soviet symbols around Sochi. For instance, I saw a portrait of Stalin on a display of a store and another portrait of Stalin in a bus. So many people today are talking about totalitarian system coming back or authoritarian regime coming back, returning Soviet Union's style, sort of repressive regime coming back to Russia. But today is a day which will be remembered by many young people as a day when, on a national holiday, Day of Russia, which celebrates Russia's independence, hundreds of people, of young people, were arrested, grabbed. Police grabbed young women and young men and dragged them away from central streets and central squares of Russian cities.
What's the significance of so many young Russians coming out for these protests?
Well, that is a very unexpected movement that began last spring in March, a few months ago, when we realized all of a sudden that lots of teenagers, young school kids and university students joined the protest. I was covering that protest in Moscow. I was on Tverskaya Street when people marched along the street. All of a sudden, I looked around. Everybody was younger than 18. They were very young school kids, and some were university students. And I was asking people, why are you here? And they said because they respected Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, the key opponent to Vladimir Putin, who criticizes the Kremlin's policy and who condemns this overwhelming corruption that basically brought Russia's economy to stagnation.
Is there a generational divide going on in terms of who's supporting a person like Navalny and who isn't?
It is a clash of ideologies. It is a clash of generations. And my character, who I've been talking with, Olga Tachone, Olga is 21 years old. She's a big-eyed, pink-haired. She dyed her hair pink.
Did she take part today?
She did. She did go and join this protest today, although almost immediately policemen took her by hands and they walked her into the police bus. And in one of the pictures, I can see Olga Tachona is showing a little sign from a window of that police bus, which says, for yours and our freedom. And that is the main slogan used by Russian dissidents.
Does the Kremlin view this kind of opposition as a real threat?
Well, judging by the number of detained people today, today on the day of Russia, people were detained even with Russian flags in their hands. The Kremlin seems to be afraid of Navalny's movement. Alexei Navalny is a young 41-year-old outspoken leader, very popular leader among young people, who says, we are the future, you are the past. You drag the country backwards into the Soviet memories, and we are the young generation of people who want to be living in a free country. That's what Olga Tachone tells me in an interview. She says that the reason why she joined the anti-corruption movement of Alexei Navalny was because she believes him. She has met with him, and she wants him for the president of her country. She wants to live in a free country. She wants to put the end to injustice, she says.
Anna Nemtsova is a journalist based in Moscow. Today she spoke to us from Sochi. Anna writes for The Daily Beast and the Fuller Project for International Reporting. We still don't know all the candidates who will be running for president next year in Mexico, but for the first time in Mexico's history, an indigenous woman is vying to be a candidate. She's Maria de Jesus Patricio Martinez, better known by her nickname, Marichuy. We first reported on her candidacy a couple of weeks ago. Since then, reporter Frank Contreras has had a chance to sit down for an interview with the candidate. So, Frank, what's Patricio like?
Carol, she's unlike any other political candidate I've ever met. She has a traditional healing center in the little town where I met her, a place called Tuxpan in the western Mexican state of Jalisco. And she's known by everyone that we spoke to. But she's unusual because she seemed to be spending more time listening to people than actually expounding what her political campaign was going to be and, you know, her presence in the media and these sorts of things. So very atypical political candidate.
And what did she tell you that she hopes to accomplish?
She said that the primary reason for this campaign is really not aimed at winning Mexico's 2018 presidential contest. She says that this organization represents Mexico's poorest, most disenfranchised people, mostly indigenous people. She's talking about the 10% of the population. That's somewhere around 14 million people who still live in conditions where malnutrition is common, where there's a lack of decent schools, healthcare clinics, and representation in the government. And so she says what this is about is bringing a voice to those people.
Now, it sounds like Patricio, she's kind of setting herself up to be a symbolic candidate to raise these issues, but she needs 850,000 signatures to get on the ballot. Do you think she'll be able to do it?
My sense is yes, she will be able to pull this off. The day before I went to visit her, I published a brief note in Facebook saying, hey, I'm going to go visit this candidate. And hundreds of people stepped up and wrote back to me wanting to know more about her, saying they would vote for her. One woman, an indigenous woman in the U.S. state of Michigan, said she's now thinking about coming back to Mexico because of the presence of this candidate. So she's really starting to gain attention. It makes me think that she will be able to pull this off and get 850,000 signatures to be able to become an official candidate for the 2018 presidential election in Mexico.
Frank, you've covered Mexico for a long time. Do you think her candidacy will change the public conversation in Mexico around the role of government and indigenous rights?
Carol, I think that it may not change it in the places where the discussion happens most publicly, in the most well-known media platforms, on television, in the newspapers. Maybe it won't be there. But it might be, you know, at the dinner table inside your home among certain people who are concerned about these issues, about how to include the most disenfranchised members of society. I think in those places, this definitely will have resonance. I can already hear people here in Mexico City talking about her and wondering what her presence in this political mix will mean about the national conversation in terms of what is electoral democracy. And how should that system work harder to include more Mexicans?
Reporter Frank Contreras in Mexico City. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Finally, I want to take you back to 30 years ago today and this iconic moment.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
President Reagan calling on Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. This month, a German symphony conductor named Marcus Rindt brought that same message to the U.S.-Mexico border. The World's Monica Campbell has that story.
Walls have been a part of Marcus Rindt's life since he was a kid.
I grew up in East Germany. I was surrounded by walls.
It was during the communist years. He remembers seeing the wall up close as a boy.
My grandfather, he showed me the wall quite often. I remember that I already, as a child, I started to invent possibilities to flee.
In 1989, in his 20s, Rindt escaped, left home, and made it to West Germany. It was one of the hardest things he ever did.
I didn't know whether I can see my parents again, my family again, because I couldn't get back when I fled. I was like a criminal for this East German government then.
Just months later, the Berlin Wall fell. Today, Rint is 49, has a boyish face, shaggy black and white hair, and he directs the Dresden Symphony. It's not a traditional orchestra. They play everything from classical and jazz to Frank Zappa and Santana. I talked to Rint while he was in Mexico City this weekend. His group was wrapping up a tour of public concerts called Tear Down This Wall, after Reagan's famous speech.
I read about this plan of President Trump to build a huge and beautiful wall, and I thought we should do an action against this, not only against this wall. You see, around Europe, increasing walls higher and higher. It's like mushrooms in the forest.
But things got complicated when they headed to the border at San Diego and Tijuana. The plan was to perform on both sides of the fence, across rusty steel beams that run out into the ocean. But that plan didn't work.
We got an email saying that we don't get permission to perform on the beach, on the American side, on the U.S. side.
No go, U.S. officials said. Too political. In a statement to the media, Border Patrol said it, quote, does not allow the federal enforcement zone to be used as a stage for an event based on a political message. Rint was disappointed, but not surprised. His orchestra has organized protest concerts before, so they performed on the Mexico side only. They invited other groups, too. The Mexican punk band called Tijuana No played a version of Spanish Bombs by The Clash. Rint's ensemble also turned the metal fence into an instrument. On the U.S. side, a small group of Trump supporters shouted, USA, USA, and held signs reading, Build the Wall. Rint said he didn't mind. That's their right. Plus, he said, he thought back to when he was a kid in East Germany, walking with his grandfather, seeing the wall there. He dreamed up many ways to cross.
I invented digging holes. I invented flying with a balloon over it, or to disguise as a deer and to jump over it.
Or in this case, playing music heard on both sides of the wall, no matter which side you were on. For The World, Monica Campbell, Mexico City.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.